Support comes from WFAE listeners and Our New South. This Charlotte-based Levine Museum podcast explores today's South through social, political, and cultural topics in their historical context, featuring conversations with locals driving change. Our New South is available on all podcast platforms.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. If you want to understand what the beer situation used to be like in this country, let me point you to the 1977 classic Burt Reynolds film, Smokey and the Bandit. The plot of that movie involves Burt and his trucker buddy smuggling 400 cases of Coors from Texarkana to Georgia because, believe it or not, back then you couldn't get Coors east of the Mississippi. Coors. Today, every town in America with more than two red lights has a craft brewery making all manner of IPAs, pilsners, stouts, and whatnot. It can be baffling to figure out what you like, much less how that beer got to be that way. Well, Tom Acatelli is here to help. Acatelli, who grew up in Charlotte, has a new book called The Golden Age of Beer. In the book, he covers 52 beer styles, one for every week of the year, describing where they came from, how they're made, what they taste like, and where to get the best versions. It's a handy guide to making your way through the thicket of craft brews. Tom and I talked about the American craft beer boom, his favorite Southern beers, how he developed his expertise, and what beer he'd buy if the only store in town was a 7-Eleven. When we were done, I was craving a cold one. Here's our conversation. You wrote about 52 beer styles, one for every week of the year, more beer styles than I knew even existed. But you also talk about what a style is. So could you kind of explain for listeners who might not be so beer savvy, sort of what makes a beer style?
Yes, Tommy, thank you very much for having me, first of all. So what makes a beer style is the characteristics of the beer. And the characteristics of the beer are tied to where the style was born and raised, so to speak. So there is a lot of history. And there is a lot of, I would say, artfulness in the early iterations of a style. So, for example, you have a style like Pilsner, which is probably still the most popular style in the world. Pilsner was born and raised in a mid-sized city called Pilsen, which you can still visit in the Czech Republic. And its characteristics were decided by what was available to the earliest brewers in Pilsen in the mid-19th century. So the type of malt was a sort of lighter colored malt that produced a very light colored beer. The hops were a sort of milder species of hop, so to speak, called saaz. So that produced the sort of crisp, semi, not as bitter as an IPA type of beer. The character, you know, what was available at the time of a style's birth and the history and the geography contribute to a style. So that's a long-winded way of saying that you could describe a beer style by what it looks like, tastes like, and what it's, especially what it's made from.
Now, one thing you mentioned in the book is that the rules for beer aren't as strict as, let's say, you know, the rules for bourbon are very strict about how it has to be made and stored and all that sort of thing. That's also true of certain wines. And I guess a kind of a fundamental question is, what makes a beer a beer?
Oh, yeah, that's a very good question. And that's something that sort of is a big part of my book, The Golden Age of Beer, and it sort of drives me a little crazy. As some of your listeners might know, you know, the beer, people like myself, beer snobs or beer aficionados tend to be very intense about different styles and what makes a style a style. You're right, the government gives very wide latitude to beer. It just basically has to be a malted beverage with alcohol, right? There's no proportion of grape variety, for instance, varietal. that you know you have to have if you're going to call a certain wine a certain type of wine. You know, like Merlot has to be made with a certain share of Merlot grapes. Bourbon has to be aged a certain way under certain conditions to call itself a bourbon. Not so for beer, right? So it has allowed brewers to for a long time now to have, you know, to sort of paint on a very wide canvas. And they have. And that's, I think, to the benefit of consumers and to the brewing reputation of the United States. Deciding what a style is can be difficult. But what I do in my book is sort of break it down by those characteristics and especially I think you can look to history and figure out, oh, you know, what's being brewed today hews to the characteristics from 100 years ago, from 500 years ago, from 50 years ago. And I also want to, you know, I want to give credit to a beer writer named Michael Jackson in the 1970s. He was an English beer writer.
Yeah, so not the Michael Jackson you're thinking of. Yeah.
Not the Michael Jackson of pop stardom, but Michael Jackson of England. He was a Fleet Street newspaper reporter and a TV producer and writer. And he basically got into beer, sort of a hobbyist. He just liked beer. And he began writing about it in a serious way that nobody before in the English language had done. And this was in the early 1970s. And by the late 1970s, he produced a book called The World Guide to Beer, which charted 24 styles, okay, which was pretty radical at the time. Basically, he invented the way that we talk. Michael Jackson invented the way that we now talk and still talk about beer style. Before Michael, people referred to types of beer or sort of broad categories, dark beer, lighter colored beer, sweeter beer, bitter beer. You can imagine, it just goes on and on. The idea of talking about beer stylistically just didn't exist the way it did exist for wine. So Michael was hugely influential in setting the parameters and the kind, sort of what I say is, you know, sort of set the conversation in motion. That continues today because of the parameters, the wide parameters that the government provides to brewers in the U.S.
So as you kind of alluded to, you structure this book, you know, through the 52 weeks of the year, and kind of you do it by seasons also. And each beer has a little section on history, a little section on trivia, some samples that you might want to try if you are interested in this type of beer. I want to kind of take the listener through one of these to sort of kind of give an idea of what it's like. So this episode is going to probably air around the third week in April. The third week in April, you highlight a style called, I believe it's Helles. Am I saying that right?
Yes, Helles, yes.
Okay. Yeah, tell us about Helles.
Okay. So Helles is a very sort of bright, effervescent lager beer from what's now Germany. It was invented, its origins date from the Middle Ages, but it sort of had a renewed popularity and vigor beginning in the late 1800s. And why was that? Because down in what was then the Austrian Empire, and where Pilsen was, Pilsner was being developed and was becoming extremely popular. Pilsen, what made Pilsen popular was nobody had seen a sort of golden colored beer to that point. Most beer until the mid 19th century was darker colored. It wasn't necessarily dark, right? That's sort of
a misconception, maybe?
Misconception, Tommy, thank you, of beer. So nobody had seen a golden colored beer. And that became sort of Pilsner's calling card. It was also very crisp. It was clear and clean. You know, if you think of Pilsner today, everything from Modelo and Budweiser to some of the craft breweries making great Pilsners right now, that sort of beer, right? So the Germans were nervous. The German brewers up north were nervous about this sort of this new competition from over the border. So they reinvigorated styles like Helles, which is lighter colored and lighter tasting and crisper. One of the remarkable things about Helles and other styles from Europe like it is if it hadn't been for American brewers beginning in the mid 20th century, sort of late 1960s, 1970s, so late 20th century too, they would have fallen out of, you know, commercial production maybe. I mean, they would have just stuck to, you know, their home bases in Germany and in other parts of Europe and not enjoyed the Renaissance that they enjoy now. We wouldn't be talking about Helles if it weren't for American brewers embracing it.
Is there a particular style or two that you can think of that sort of surprised and delighted you as you were drinking?
Yeah, I definitely tasted all these styles prior to and during the writing of the book, which started in the, you know, the early days of the pandemic. So I had time. What styles jumped out at me? I'm always curious about new iterations of bitterer beers. I think craft beer in the United States reached kind of an end of history moment about 10 years ago with, you know, New England style IPA, right? New England IPA or hazy IPA. Brewers were always trying to top themselves by in bitterness and in alcoholic strength and in haziness. And so I was very curious to explore that phenomenon more. And so I really got into New England IPA and the origins of that. But that also led me to, you know, a renewed appreciation for balance when it comes to bitterness. So I got into India Pale Lager, which is a relatively young style of beer invented in the United States, maybe 15 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, definitely this century. And India Pale Lager is less bitter than IPA and not as full in taste or mouthfeel as IPA. And that's not a bad thing. It's sort of a work of art to balance the bitterness, to balance the hops, the different varietals of hops you're using, to make a bitter beer taste almost sweet and refreshing. And I think that, you know, the better IPAs are like that. And they're much more drinkable, I think, than some of the, you know, the excruciatingly hazy and excruciatingly bitter IPAs that have come out in the last 15 years. And like a lot of sort of beer aficionados, beer geeks over the last several years, I got a renewed appreciation for lagers in general. As some of your listeners know, you know, there's two main types of beer. There's ales and there's lagers. Ales tend to be heavier, stronger, meatier almost, meal in a glass, you know, the barley wines, the Scottish style, the Scottish ales. Lagers tend to be lighter and crisper. And from my understanding, you know, lagers are sort of a, you know, the brewer's art. You know, you have to nail it. You have to really know your stuff, know your chemistry to get a lager right.
It strikes me as you talk about this, I'm old enough to remember a time when we probably, this conversation wouldn't have made any sense, you know, because 25, 30 years ago, there were virtually no styles of beer that you could just, a normal person could just walk into a pub or a store and buy. You know, I remember like Sam Adams and Anchor Steam being kind of like the only different beers that you might see somewhere. And of course, now it's exploded in every town of any size has multiple brew pubs making all different types of styles of beer. Could you explain a little bit about how that happened?
That's a great question. I grew up in Charlotte, North Carolina. My family moved from upstate New York when I was two. So we were part of the Northern Infusion that changed a lot of the metro area. And I left Charlotte I think it was 2002. I don't think there were any breweries in Mecklenburg County. And now there must be 15 to 20.
There's like six within a mile of my house.
There's been this extraordinary growth since the 1960s and the number of breweries and the number of styles available. Because you're absolutely right. You know, 25 years ago, this would have been a very difficult conversation to have. It would have been almost impossible 35 or 40 years ago. Yeah. So basically, in a nutshell, 1965, a appliance heir named Fritz Maytag, yes, of the Maytag appliances, rescues the Anchor Brewing Company in San Francisco, which was the last brewery, independently owned brewery in the United States making beer with traditional ingredients, traditional methods. So there was no adjuncts. There was no corn, for instance, or no, you know, just was straight ahead, you know, malted barley or malted wheat and hops, water, and the yeast, right? And very limited distribution. So Maytag rescues Anchor. By the mid-1970s, it's still the only game in town. Most smaller breweries, most even regionals, have gone out of business or they've been absorbed by the bigger players. You know, Anheuser-Busch and Miller are getting bigger and bigger. Coors is considered the new kid on the block in a way. It's a little bit smaller. It's not really available east of the Mississippi River. You know, there were predictions at the start of the 1970s that there would be one or two U.S. breweries by the 21st century. Then there is a tax law change in 1976. President Ford signs into law at the urging of a fellow Michigander named Peter Stroh's. I don't know if anybody remembers the old Stroh's Brewery.
Sure, yeah. But
there used to be one in North Carolina, I think, in Winston-Salem. So that makes it cheaper. It's an excise tax cut. So it makes it cheaper to brew beer, basically. 1978, President Carter signs into law the legalization of home brewing at the urging, actually, of some winemaking, wine supply companies and wine lobbyists in California. And why do they want home brewing to be legal? Because they wanted new customers for their wine shops, their wine supply shops. See, at the end of Prohibition in 1933, winemaking was legalized, home winemaking was legalized just as a matter of course. It was just sort of an afterthought and it was done. Home brewing was not. But home brewing was not legalized at the federal level until late 1978, took effect, I think, in 79. By that time, there were a couple breweries in California. There was one in Colorado. There was the first brew pub in Washington State. But, you know, it's very small. It's extremely tough to break in. You know, even if you can make the beer and get the supplies, you still have to compete for distribution with Anheuser-Busch, Miller, Coors, et cetera. So not much happens, but you allude to the key point, the sort of key turning point. It comes in the mid-1980s. There's these two sort of startup companies, one on the West Coast in Silicon Valley, and one in the Boston area. The one on the West Coast was Pete's Wicked, and the one on the East Coast was Samuel Adams, the Boston Beer Company. And so these guys used contract brewing, which is basically they didn't have physical breweries, but they rented space at other breweries that had excess space. And there were a lot of breweries that had excess space at this point, because again, they were either going out of business or they were about to be acquired by the bigger players. And pretty soon you could get Sam Adams and Pete's Wicked. It was they were all over the place by the early 1990s. Further tax changes, further availability of supplies, better distribution, things start to really take off in the 1990s.
It feels like to me sometimes that, you know, like I said, there's so many brew pubs just within an arm's reach of me that feels unsustainable somehow. And I'm wondering if you've noticed, is there starting to be like a sell-off in this, or is this part of the world that just keeps growing?
My first beer book was called The Audacity of Hops, and it was basically a history of craft beer. And I interviewed Tony McGee, who was the founder of Lagunitas, which Heineken acquired over a couple of deals about, I don't know how long ago, maybe 10 years now, 2015. Tony said to me, you know, he was a paper salesman and, you know, just who liked to homebrew. And he got these homebrewing supplies in California and he had a lot of options. Anyway, he you know, started very much from the ground up using old equipment, secondhand equipment. He described the early days of craft beer as, you know, the tyranny of fast growth. So the more popular his brewery became and other breweries become, it just amps up your costs. The capital costs go up. It becomes harder and harder to make beer at a profit. I don't want to say it's not sustainable, but it's much tougher. I don't think there is the appetite in the marketplace right now for the number of breweries there are. There's something like 8,000 to 9,000. I used to joke 10, 15 years ago that I would get asked, like, how many, you know, how long can this go on? Is it a fad? And I said, no, it's most definitely not a fad. The consumer tastes have changed and there's so many styles available and so many sources of information. We're not going back, you know, but it depended on how much beer Americans can drink. But it really does now depend on that because number one, the younger generations are not drinking as much. They're not drinking much alcohol, period. Millennials, Gen Zs. So there's that. Number two, there's competition in the alcohol marketplace that just wasn't there 15 years ago. I mean, as best as I can chart, you know, hard seltzer dates from maybe 2011, 2010. So, you know, it's just exploded. There's new forms of competition out there that weren't there. There's new challenges that weren't there a decade ago that are there for these breweries. So I think what you're seeing now, and you are seeing now, is another round of consolidation in the industry where larger craft breweries are buying up smaller operations or, and this is the case in the Northeast, especially, craft breweries banding together and sort of forming cooperatives. Like they put their brands under one umbrella to survive. It's an interesting time. It's a fantastic time to be a consumer. There's so much variety. You walk into a shop, there's so many styles available. The business side is different.
When we come back, Tom McAtelli talks about how he learned world history through beer history.
And I also, began to connect the history of brewing and the history of beer with a lot of history in the United States and in the world. So it just became very interesting to me to see that intersection.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Before we get back to this episode, I wanted to ask for a little help with something. If you enjoy Southbound, please give us a good rating and write us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast provider you have that allows such things. The more reviews and better ratings we get, the better chance there is that other listeners can find us. But to be honest, I'd just as soon you tell people about Southbound through good old word of mouth. If you could recommend it to just one person you know, somebody you might think would enjoy interesting conversations about the South, I'd be deeply grateful. If you have any thoughts about the show, guests to recommend, or anything that you think might make Southbound better, you can email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. Thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time. And now, back to my conversation with Tom McAtelli. So this is a podcast about the South. I noticed as I was reading the book that there was one particular type of beer that had Southern origins called Kentucky Common. Could you tell us a little bit about that one?
It's one of the few styles born in the United States. I want to say that first. Most styles were born in Northern Europe or Central Europe, but Kentucky Common, rose up around the 1850s when Kentucky became a state in 1792, right? It had been part of Virginia. And basically, people were pushing west, right? And, since time immemorial, human beings want to make some alcohol. So that's how we get, that's how bourbon grew up. That was one of the things they made. But they also made a relatively quick beer. And by quick, I mean Kentucky Common could be made, I'd say, like a few weeks from the mash, from the, the making of the beer and the start of fermentation to mug, mash to mug in maybe a few weeks, right? It was rudimentary. It was whatever they had at hand. By all accounts, it had sort of a sour kind of off taste. But again, it was what was available and what they could do on the other side as they got, over the Appalachians. It has a sort of an amber to light brown color back then. And even today, the few breweries that are doing it, they're resurrecting it. It's not a bitter beer. Kentucky Common is not a bitter style. It's more malt forward. It's got a medium to heavy body. So you can drink, it's not a meal in a glass type style. Today, we don't know if this was the case, 170 years ago, but there's really high carbonation today. So it's sort of a bubbly style. It's interesting because it does get back to what we were saying earlier. This is the history and the characteristics, the early characteristics are what formed the style. And the other interesting part too is Kentucky Common was like some of these European styles, like a lot of them, was rescued by American craft brewers. It had fallen out of commercial circulation and until it was picked up fairly recently, I'd say in the last 10, 15 years.
Do you find that there are differences in sort of beer drinking patterns in regions of the country? Like the Southern beer drinkers drink differently than people in the Northeast?
I would think that lighter styles, lighter tasting styles are probably more popular in the South than they are up North. And what I mean by lighter styles, I mean like the Helles, like the Pilsners, like Kolsch, which was another beer that was sort of resurrected again to compete with Pilsner. So yeah, I'm thinking of like St. Arnold in what was the first craft brewery in Texas, and they had a lager called Lawnmower Beer because basically that, you know, it was sort of a joke on, you know, it was a sort of beer, lighter beer that you would drink while you're mowing your lawn in the hot southern sun.
Are there southern breweries that you particularly like any places in particular that you could think of that are doing really good work?
Oh, I don't want to leave anybody out.
Well, yeah, I know. With the understanding that, yeah, you're not going to get to
all. Yeah. I love the Noda Brewery in Mecklenburg County. I think it's, yeah.
Sure.
Charlotte Noda is fantastic. Old Mecklenburg is great.
Sure.
They make a copper ale. I can't remember the style.
I think it's just called Copper.
Yeah, it's an alt beer. It's a German style. Alt is German for old, and it's sort of a throwback to, you know, the maltier, sort of heavier lager style. So that's one that I really like. Sweetwater, I think, is out of Atlanta, right? They're fantastic. But yeah, there's a lot going on in the South as far as beer, and it's always interesting to visit and to see it. It's going through earlier iterations of evolution than different parts of the country have gone through already. Like the West Coast, you know, they're especially California, Oregon, Washington State, they're in, you know, third generation of this, right? You know, the South is maybe one and a half, two generations. So it's interesting to see that.
So I want to talk a little bit about kind of your background and how all this happened for you. But sir, I can't help but ask this question. Do you remember your first beer?
Yeah. All right. I just want to correct myself. All beer is a lager. It's not a lager. It's an ale. But
Okay. We'll get
it. Do I remember my first beer? It was probably like Budweiser or something like that. I did not come from a beer household. My parents rarely drank anything. And if they did, they were the children of Italian immigrants. So it was usually wine, red wine. I can't remember the very first, but I do remember getting into like Pete's Wicked and Sam Adams. And there were some other, you know, early craft beers or craft offerings from the big guys. Like, you know, I remember Blue Moon being popular. That's a Coors production. And I remember, yeah, these beers I got into when I was in college at UNC.
So I want to ask about college, because college is the time when many of us drink a lot of cheap beer, by the pitcher or something like that. But it sounds like that's also when you started to get into more craft beers.
That was just sort of by happenstance, not wanting to drink the cheaper stuff anymore and having a little money to buy the more expensive crafts that were out there. I also got, you know, just sort of a better appreciation of the origins. Once I learned sort of some of the history and some of the business behind the brewing, that more made it more interesting to me and something I wanted to pursue. And so I began writing about the business side of brewing quite a bit, and that turned into my first book. And I just gained an appreciation for the sort of entrepreneurial approach and spirit that went into these brews. And I also, you know, began to connect the history of brewing and the history of beer with a lot of history in the United States and in the world. So it just became very interesting to me to see that intersection, you know. But as far as taste, I don't know. I just decided to make the leap. And I don't want to knock some of these macro productions like Budweiser, like Heineken. It takes a tremendous amount of skill to produce these beers the same way all over the world and have them taste the same when they're shipped and bought. So that in itself is, you know, it's an engineering feat. It might not be the art of brewing, but it's certainly an engineering feat.
So how did you end up building expertise in this field? Like, I'm imagining you know, going to a brew pub, sampling, you know, maybe taking a flight of different kinds of beers and taking notes or something. How did that actually work for you? Like, how did you figure all this out?
It has been a lot of visits and a lot of drinking, but mostly, you know, it's been a wonderful experience in meeting people and talking to different people in different parts of the country. One of the great things I think about the craft beer industry still is that people want to talk about what they do, and they want to describe it, and they want to argue over it, and they want to debate it. So I was very lucky to hit the sort of first wave of the 21st century. You know, there, like we discussed, there had been a rise, a sharp rise beginning in the early 1990s, and there had been the initial rise beginning in the mid 1960s, but it really, you know, started to take off again after about 2001, 2002. And I was lucky to catch it then. And back then you could meet with some of the even, you know, bigger owners and bigger brewmasters, and they would make time for you to talk about what they were doing.
So what does your refrigerator usually look like? I mean, do you have a bunch of different styles in there? Are there one or two go-tos that are always going to be in there?
Oh, that's well, I actually just picked up, I just started homebrewing again after about 10 years.
So I was going to ask that. Okay. How's that going?
It's going well. An IPA is just a sort of straight ahead centennial hopped, cascade hopped IPA gurgling in the basement right now. As for what's in the fridge, you know, I usually try to keep one of those milder, more balanced IPAs or an IPL. I love, you know, well-made Pilsner. I think it's a work of art. I think that is really the sort of, and I'm not the only one who shares this opinion, but it's sort of the pinnacle of the brewer's art. Mostly because if you have an imperfection, you can't hide it in the heaviness. You can't hide it in the alcoholic kick. You can't hide it in the haziness. It's just right there. You know, you can hold a Pilsner up to the light and see if it's done right. And, you know, I like to drink seasonally. So, which is, you know, reflected in my book. I'll have the barley wines and the stouts and the Christmas ales in the winter. I'll have the, you know, the Kolsch's and the Helles's and even more Pilsner in the summertime. I'll have, you know, sort of the early spring, the Maybox. I'll have a Marzen and or, you know, an Oktoberfest in the fall. And when I go to the South, when I visit relatives in North Carolina and elsewhere, I will try to drink locally, which I think is, you know, one of the easiest ways to make sense of the consumer marketplace of beer right now in the United States is to drink what's near you. Just drink local.
Something you said rang a bell with me just now, and I wanted to kind of ask about that. So when I go into a brew pub, I'm more of a Pilsner lager type person. But when I go to the brew pub, I tend to find that there are way more IPAs and that sort of thing than those lighter beers or the less bitter beers. Is that because the Pilsners are harder to make, or is it simply because more people like IPAs?
Yes. The answer to both is yes. Pilsner can be more difficult to make. Lagers can be difficult to make. They have to be aged longer under cooler conditions. So increased cost for refrigeration, for instance. They're just harder to make. And that's why, I mean, that's why I'm homebrewing an IPA right now, because ales are easier to homebrew. And if I make if I make a mistake in my basement, it might not be as perceptible. Right, because it's going to be higher in alcohol, it's going to be heavier in taste, it's going to be busier in its appearance and its mouthfeel. IPAs, they had a rocket ship rise beginning in the 1990s. You had Lagunitas, was the first California brewery to lead with an IPA. As hard as it is to believe, IPA was not that popular even in craft beer, and by the 1990s, it all but disappeared commercially in North America. It had this rocket ship rise. It was almost a reaction to the watery Pilsners that were out there from the bigger producers, I think. You know, IPA just sort of just took off and became the touchstone, lodestar, whatever term you want to use, for craft brewing in the United States. If you started after Lagunitas, after the 1990s, if you start, you know, after Stone Brewing, you know, they started leading with IPAs around the same time. If you were going to start a brewery, that's what you did.
I want to wrap up with sort of a stranded on a desert island type question. So let's say, you know, you have a friend who lives in a small town and you go to visit them and they say, Tom, could you stop by somewhere and bring us a six pack that we can enjoy together?
Oh my.
And you get to the town and the only place that's open is like a 7-Eleven. And you have to go in there and from what's available, get the beer that you think is best. What are you buying?
I do stop at a kind of 7-Eleven place when I go see some relatives in upstate New York. We stop at the same place to gas up, and they have a pretty good selection of local breweries. And I will try to find the most balanced ale I can find. I want a malty upfront taste, like sweet. Okay. I want a bitter aftertaste and finish. And I want sort of lighter tasting, hard but hearty mouthfeel. And basically, and I don't want it to have too much of an alcoholic kick, but I want it to be sort of a mellow, warming beer. So
I think the question I'm getting to is like of the big commercial beers that are out there that everybody knows, what fits that description that you just gave the best?
Okay, so we're at a 7-Eleven, we're at a gas station.
Right, we're at a gas station.
I'm imagining I would find a Samuel Adams Boston Lager.
Okay, so they would have that at this. Yeah.
Vienna style, Vienna Lager, and because I know the history and because I know the style, I will appreciate it that much more. But I also, Tommy, I want to just reiterate, like, as you said at the beginning, we couldn't have had, I couldn't have just described beer and stopping at a gas station in the South or anywhere. We couldn't have talked about picking up a beer in this way. Just things have changed so much. So for the better, I think.
I'll admit to being whatever the opposite of a beer snob is. When I first started going to craft breweries, I would ask for whatever tasted most like a Yingling. And I'm still not into the bitter IPAs and such. But I've been amazed over the years to learn about the many types of beer and the many types of beer drinkers. And it's been heartening to see a beer culture that used to be dominated by three or four big companies returning to its local roots. Brewpubs have by and large become a classic third place. Not work, not home, but a safe spot to unwind with your friends, or even your kids. Tom Acatelli knows that world inside out, and it's always fun to talk to somebody with great enthusiasm for what they do. He understands better than most how the beer in front of him made its journey through time and into the glass. Now, that's not something most of us think about when we're quaffing a cold one on a hot summer day, but it is nice to know that every beer has a history. And we're drinking a little bit of that history every time we tip one back. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our editors are Eli Portillo and Jen Lang. Our main theme music comes from Joshua Lee Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Subscribe for free to get each new episode sent to you when it's ready. You can also find Southbound on our website. Just go to wfae.org/podcast/southbound. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.